So welcome, everyone. So this is August 8th, 2009, and this is a teleconference that is going to feature around the concept of the observer self in the Pathwork Guide Lectures. The observer self is an interesting situation because the phrase, although it's very commonly used, does not actually appear anywhere in the lectures. The guide talks about an observer, whatever, observer voice, but he doesn't use that actual term. And I did a word search just before the teleconference, and he uses it, the word observer, 8 times. And he's got observed and, you know, various forms of it. But I wanted to check my facts before I told you that it wasn't in the lectures. But the concept itself was so, I guess, so obvious. I don't know exactly where the term came from. Back in 1988, Susan Thesinga, who was one of the original helpers that worked with Ava and has been with the Pathwork almost since the beginning, put together what was designed as a workbook. All the other Pathwork books are portions of lectures strung together so that you get the highlights on a concept. So in all the other books, they'll have a chapter heading, and they'll pick up paragraphs or pages from various lectures that support and explain that concept. But the material itself, except for the forewords and the introductions, are actually the Pathwork lectures. Susan's book, The Undefended Self, is the only book that was constructed, that was authored, within Pathwork. It's specifically on the subject of the lectures by Pathwork Press. And it's formatted so that it can be used in a self-study group, for instance, and it's got exercises after each chapter, and it's got questions for you to answer. And Susan brought in from her wealth of experience case studies, obviously disguising the actual individual involved, that gave more of a flavor of what working with Pathwork concepts looks like. The guide was very seldom specific with people. He did do private sessions periodically, but in the overall lectures presented, there wasn't a lot of case study material. It's not like the process work that we do now in Pathwork, where we talk at some length about the particular issue and the particular circumstance of someone's questions or concerns. The guide tended to keep these relatively general. So it's an excellent use of Pathwork concepts in modern-day language by a person with extensive experience both with Pathwork and with various types of therapy. So it's a fascinating book. I chose The Observer Self because, as I said, it's not clearly and specifically outlined in the lectures, and yet it's in dozens of the lectures. The concept itself is throughout a number of lectures. Now, she references in her chapter, Pathwork Guide Lecture 189, in quotes, more than any other. But that still talks about a wider subject and different subjects than the actual observer self. So the use of this book in particular for me is this chapter, number 3, on the observer self. Now, a Pathworker in Australia actually typed or set up the entire chapter, and so that can be downloaded in its entirety from the website. And I hope that you will download it and that you might be intrigued enough to possibly take a look at the rest of the book. So that's the material I'm using, is that chapter. And I have posted, or will post on the internet tonight, some notes from the book. So you'll have the chapter, you'll have some notes that I've taken, and some notes from Lecture 189 to give you a kind of a well-rounded sense of source material on this. So before I start to talk about the observer self, there are 3 things that perhaps need to be discussed before we go into it. The first is, in the Pathwork, there is a message. What the guide says very often is that seeing something is not being it. That feeling an emotion is not the same as acting it out. I'm going to have to take a break for just a second. I've got an equipment problem here. There we go. Sorry about that. So, the guide very often invites us to explore unpleasant or scary feelings. And he says that just because you feel anger is not the same, and it is not an invitation to act it out. But because we may have been holding back anger for a long period of time, it feels to us sometimes as if when we explore unpleasant emotions or emotions that aren't easy for us to handle, we're not facile at it, we haven't dealt with them very often, we don't quite know what's involved or what the feeling is, that when we are handling very unpleasant emotions, we hold a fear that we may not actually know how big the issue is, how angry we are, how upset we are, and that there's a fear of spillover. So there's a real concern there. And yet, feeling anger, allowing yourself to feel anger, is quite distinct from acting out that anger on someone else. And this is the distinction that we hold in the personal exploration of our feelings versus the accidental or unconscious or careless and thoughtless exhibition of those feelings, especially when blame is attached to them. So particularly in terms of the observer self, to be able to see a situation is distinct from being the situation, allowing it to continue, approving of it, having things run out of control. Talking about a different thing here. And this is mentioned in both the lectures, and I'll go into it. The second thing is that whenever we talk about the observer self, we are already talking about the existence of an I. We may not speak in those terms to ourselves, but when we speak, there is some central vortex in you that speaks for different feelings, different energies, different perspectives and ideas that you may have within yourself. And the voice that actually speaks that is the I voice. The I voice is not the observer self. And the third point that I want to delineate before we start is that a lot of what Pathwork is about developing different attitudes towards a situation. And again, like the observer self, there isn't necessarily one key lecture on attitude per se. I had a teacher once who asked me to run a computer search on the word attitude. She said that she suspected that it was terribly important, but she couldn't find information on it. So I had a copy of an old-fashioned search engine program, the first one that came out, and she didn't have a copy of it. So she asked me if I would run this word search and print it out for her. And we had done these periodically. You might get 2 pages of quotes. You might get 5 pages of quotes. So I went to my computer, and I put in attitude. And without reading the screen and without noticing what was going to happen, I hit print and went and had a meal. And I came back about 45 minutes later to see 200 printed pages in my computer, and it was out of paper and asking for more. So I put another batch of paper in, and it printed more or less another 150 pages. So with this massive chunk of 350 pages of material in 9-point print, 2 pages per sheet of paper, I presented this to my teacher and said, I think you have found something of importance here. Attitude seems to be a key factor in the pathwork. Yet, interestingly, there isn't a specific single lecture on it. It is simply mentioned throughout. So again, what we're looking at here is inviting people to consider changing their attitude towards something, because attitude actually counts for more than you may realize. Attitude is huge. It changes everything. So with not being what you see or acting out what you feel, and understanding that there's an I that is in you and that that manifests and speaks, and that attitude changes everything. Let's go ahead and go into the details on the observer self. So Susan runs a lot of very interesting analogies. I like them very much. And to start off with, what she says is that the inner voices, which some of us remember the old joke about if you talk to yourself, you're crazy. And then the next joke is, no, not unless you answer, or not unless you disagree, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the truth is that everybody talks to themselves, and everyone has a variety of voices going on in them. The place of mental illness is where you don't realize that these are different voices within you, where you believe you're being spoken to by other people, where you have lost a sense of reality. But I've never known anyone who doesn't have different aspects of their personality, their history, their values, their interests, speaking to them, and it's like a cacophonous sea of voices sometimes. And so Susan analogizes it to having a cast of characters inside you. Now, if this isn't your experience, I have a couple examples that might fit. If you've learned to drive back in the days when you learned to drive, or if you have ever learned to operate something where it was very, very crucial that you did specific things in a specific sequence so that you had an instructor sitting right next to you and constantly commenting as you performed the task. So getting a driver's license or piloting a plane or doing anything where the instructor could not simply let you go and leave you alone and check in a day or an hour or watch you go, where they needed to put input in on a constant, continual basis. At the same time, they were giving you tips and techniques and other things to help you feel more comfortable with the process. That this would be an example of a real-life outer voice. And as you start to do this activity on your own, you start to internalize that voice, and perhaps with other voices, but specifically an instructor's voice, especially if the instructor was fair and helpful, tends to be a voice that we are willing to internalize very easily and willingly, so that you might hear your instructor as you're driving along say something about left-hand turns or U-turns or going too fast or something like that. And then at a later time, the voice becomes your voice. And that's when you have fully integrated the external voice and the external information, and you've converted it into your style of driving, what you care about, what you value, how polite you wish to be, how within the law you wish to be. And so your own voice will take over at that point, saying, whoops, or watch out, or remember to do the left, take the left turn. That's just one example of an internal voice. Now, another example of internal voices are the voices of our parents. But there's a distinction here, and that is that our parents' voices, when we heard those voices, we were not as well developed as we may have been at 16 or 20 or 25 when we engaged in adult activities with an instructor. So when we originally heard our parents' voices, they were the voice of God. They were the ultimate authority. They controlled everything in our life. They gave and held back love. They provided food, shelter, and clothing. These were very important voices. So when we heard those voices and began to internalize them and bring them in, we didn't have a strong ego at that time. And we were in an immature and juvenile state so that the voices may have come in ways that we were not making an evaluation about the voice. So it's a different kind of voice because it came in when we were younger and less conscious of what might be behind the voice. So this is the kind of voice where you pick up from your father or your mother, and there are positive voices, of course. We don't focus on the positive voices here because they don't need any healing. We focus on the voices that have created a problem. A place where a parent's voice might say, you're always careless. And it may have been repeated so many times that we have internalized that voice so that we take on the role of parent with the best of intentions to keep ourselves out of danger, to keep ourselves socially acceptable, to not break things. And we hear that voice, but we will probably hear the voice with some of the tones of the original parental voice. So parents not being perfect, if they were short-tempered or curt and said, you're always careless, we might still have a remnant of that voice inside us, where we hear the finger wagging saying, you're always careless. So this would be another in cast of characters. These are the kinds of voices that we're talking about. And when we're working with voices and parts of our personality, we're always focused on the less mature voices, the ones that need support and help, and any voice that is negative or not constructive. So we're looking at a leftover voice that was never meant to hang around for 20, 30, 40 years, that still wags its finger and chides us and makes us feel bad. These are the kinds of voices that we're actually looking for, and you will find others as you explore the internal cast of characters in your own mind. Another way of looking at this is that there are different energies inside us. And we may hear the energy in terms of phrasing, and that's another way to look at the voices. So if we have an energy of play and fun, we might describe that as the child's voice, the child's point of view, the child's perspective. And another analogy she makes here is that we don't realize that these voices are like frequencies on a radio dial. And we move around and through them. And we may be listening to the child's voice when there are other voices as well in the background. And so part of developing the observer self is to come up above the fray of this cast of characters and keep an eye out for what is important, what is the priority in a given moment. And the way she analogizes that is the observer self takes the position of being part of the audience so that it can offer you feedback. In terms of feedback, I was trying to think of all the different ways I could express this. And while I was doing it, I got up in the night and I went to type on the computer, but I didn't turn on the light. And as I watched the screen, I realized I was typing complete garbage. And so I had to turn on a light because I'm not a touch typist. He is odd. With just a small nightlight on, I could type quite accurately. But without any light at all, I was just that uncertain of where my fingers were, so that if I got out of alignment, I'd be typing blah, blah, blah into the computer. And so I'm bringing that up now because feedback, you don't have to have 100% feedback for it to be useful. Just having a small amount of feedback is enough to keep you on track. So in the perhaps silly analogy of typing without any light and not really knowing where your fingers are, and typing with just a very soft light so that you can get a better sense out of the peripheral vision of where your hands are on the keyboard, you might only make one or two mistakes working like that. But that's all feedback really needs to be. It is not meant to be a ball and chain around you, stopping you from progressing. Good feedback, well given and timely, can allow you to move quickly and easily with grace in the activity that you're in. It's as if there's somebody watching out for you. So, back to the observer self. That there is the voice of the I. And without trying to tell people how to think or how to phrase, right now I'm going to call that the voice of the ego. That when I speak, it is my consciousness that speaks. And that consciousness may include various voices and attitudes and frequencies. But I identify my voice versus my repeating words that belong to someone else or attitudes that belong to someone else. The observer self is different from the I. So the I is what is speaking to you right now. The I hears the ideas running around in my head, and it decides what sequence to put them forward in. The observer self, once again, as if it were part of an audience, might be the part of me that says, you're speaking too fast, slow down, you forgot point number three. Input like that from a place of not being involved and invested, not being concerned, not being sweaty and full of stage fright, not having a million things to try to handle, the observer self at its best is an independent point of view. And I state that because if you develop the observer self, that's one of the key things to look for, is that voice independent, or is it part of the mad rush to get something done? If it's part of the rush to get something done, it may be part of your ego or your child self or however you name all these other voices. Because the real observer self, the way we're delineating it, is neutral and not involved. Its job is simply to observe and offer feedback to you. So that self, the observer self, is the only one that can really work on a regular basis with all the other selves in you. Everyone else is invested in getting their thing done. The child wants to go play, the adult wants to go to work, the spouse wants to take care of the family, the daughter wants to call home and talk to their parent. There's a lot of different needs within us. There's a lot of background noise right now. If you think it might be you, if you could press star 6, that would be useful. And that mutes your phone. Star 6 will unmute it later on. So the observer self works with the other selves, but stands independent from them. And the idea is that not only the observer self, but other parts of us that are more mature can also assist the less developed parts. So the observer self doesn't have to do everything. But without having developed that, without going through the exercise of developing an independent and neutral voice, we may not be able to identify when the other voices are occasionally neutral and independent. Well, I hope that makes sense. So also developing this voice allows us to observe ourselves Developing this voice allows us to observe ourselves objectively and compassionately. And what Susan says is that the ability to do this, to observe ourselves objectively and compassionately, is the single most important skill in walking a spiritual path. Once again, because of feedback. So what are the distortions from this? Well, one is that we're not a deck of cards. So I can't say, where's the ace, where's the 2, where's the 10? I cannot delineate my inner reality so clearly that I'm absolutely able to be independent and name an observer self and know that at all times that is a neutral and independent voice. It's an organic reality, our inner lives. So one of the qualities that the observer self is going to have is to realize when it has become blurred so that it can step back. So in other words, if you have the voice of the objective observer and it's speaking of what it sees, but it starts to get, the voice starts to be rushed and say, oh, we need to hurry, we're going to be late, and emotion starts entering into it, then the observer self has merged in with the needs of the other parts of you. And the observer self is going to need to be able to step back. And once we talked about attitude in the beginning, the simple attitude of the observer self is, oh, I need to step back. So why would the objective observer need to step back? And the two distortions that Susan explains in the chapter is that the two things that we might find that put us off kilter and start the emotions running and don't allow us to be objective anymore is judgments and finding negativity. And there might also be immaturity, but that would go in with judgment. So we have judgments against when we are behaving in a manner that we do not find admirable or appropriate. The two things that would set off the observer self and cause it to perhaps lose its objectivity is buying into a judgment about what is going on and feeling that there is negativity involved and feeling responsible for it. So the explanation to judgments within the pathwork concept is that judgments come from our idealized self-image. I did a teleconference a few months ago on that, so I've explained it at length, and there are a lot of lectures on images in the pathwork lectures. But basically, the idealized self-image sets up a standard that is perfectionistic and out of our reach as human beings, as fallible human beings in an organic phase of growth. And with that template of what we are supposed to be, what we should be, we measure ourselves against that with some level of harshness. So the judgments on us would say, you could do better if you had done your homework, if you had tried harder, if you'd arrived earlier in the day, if this, if that, you could have. Holding a standard of what was possible and telling us that we fell short. Judgment against that is different from a simple observation that the observer self might be able to offer, such as, you have a habit of being late, and you were late today, and this creates tension. Perhaps we might consider not being so late in future. Rather than judging how we got into this and what the circumstances were, and saying that we are deficient, the observer self simply names what is, and perhaps names some of the things that got us into that predicament in the first place. So that's judgments, and they come from the idealized self-image. The second place where we can lose our objectivity is having a sense that we're bad. And this is where Lecture 189 spends a lot more time than the observer self chapter, but there is some of it. And I'm going to read a quote from 189 that is discussed in the observer self chapter. This is regarding negativity. Pafford takes a different attitude towards negativity than many other spiritual disciplines, and I find that 189 brilliantly categorizes and explains where such negativity comes from a spiritual perspective. It is the task of human entities to carry negative aspects with them for the purpose of integrating and synthesizing them. When you come into this life, you specifically bring negative aspects with you for the purpose of transformation. What 189 is saying is that it is not an accident that we have negative elements within us, that it is part of our spiritual growth that we allowed and brought these elements into our lives for the specific purpose of transformation. And this perspective is one of human beings being spiritual beings and incorporating not only our biological and social lives here, but our larger purpose on a divine level. So what the observer self can do when negativities do come to the surface, when you become more conscious of negativity, is the observer self can help you track, what is this about? What is going on? Where does this relate to? Where does the fuel come for this? Rather than pointing and saying that this is negative and not wanting to deal with it, or shutting it out, or labeling it as bad, because most of us are going to go into defense about that. We're going to feel that there's something wrong with us. And if you have the sense that there's something terribly wrong with you, then it's very hard to take an authoritative look at what the situation is and say, what do we do about it? So the observer self can put you, to some degree, in the driver's seat in terms of your transformative process, in terms of working with your character defects and flaws, with working with emotions that are out of control or immature, and working at the triggers that seem to set you off. The observer self can stand and help you see what is going on, what it might be related to, and how we might address it. And in speaking of the we, once again, that's the compassion in the observer self. It isn't a foreign voice out of the blue. It's not the voice of God. It is your own voice, wanting to deal with what is in front of us, wanting to grow, and wanting to be the best that we can possibly be. In effect, it's as if human beings are like I'm going to use the phrase rosebud. I'm sure there are other flowers, but in my head I've got rosebud, so there we go. It's like a human being's a rosebud. And with encouragement, we can bloom, and we can be spectacular. But under the influence of criticism, of feeling like we're bad, feeling like there's a mistake, oh my God, if I open up, what if I'm not pretty enough? What if I'm not full enough? What if I'm the wrong color? What if? That for the human being, for human beings as spiritual beings to flourish and grow, what we need is a positive and supportive environment. Now, no person gets that from human parents. You can get a lot from your parents, as positive as they are. And we always want more. So whether you've had parents that you don't care for and you don't think are supportive, or you've had parents that were phenomenally supportive, you will still want to improve who you are and what you're doing. That's the nature of human beings. And so the observer self can, in effect, become the inner parent that takes all the wonderful qualities from your human parents, from the authorities that you grew up with, from the teachers, from every aspect of humanity that you've ever come in contact with, can be synthesized into you. Create a voice that holds you with as much love and compassion as you can carry, and also allows you to see as much truth as you can consciously perceive. So then Susan goes into two aspects of the observer self, one being truth and the other being love. And she does that because it is critically important that the observer self offer a chance for us to see what is real. In effect, the observer becomes a reality check for us. a place where we can be angry at someone and say, they're always like that, and they're always chewing me out. And the observer self says, no, not really. They did it today, and it hurt today, but they actually don't criticize you that often. On the other hand, the observer self could say, yes, that's true, and encourage a dialogue and a discussion on why we would be in proximity with negative people. Why would we keep going back to a situation that didn't feel good, where we were criticized all the time, where our best efforts were not accepted? So I can't speak of specifics here because everyone's situation in every single moment is radically different. And yet all of us have experienced this. The observer self is not a stranger to us. The use of the observer self in unpleasant, negative, or frightening situations may be a novel concept to us. But everyone does a double check in their head sometimes about what did I hear and what was I thinking, and doing that chore on their own. So in terms of truth, Susan writes, learning to accept ourselves, to forgive and have compassion for every hidden thought and feeling and every action, no matter how apparently unacceptable, is the same as learning to live in love. And the practice of honest self-observation will teach us about truth and love. We learn honesty with the self combined with total acceptance of the self. So the observer self having these two qualities, being willing and able to speak the truth, but to speak it with love. Then we come around to attitudes. So in terms of constructive attitudes, being truthful with the self means welcoming unconscious material into consciousness, even if this material comes in the form of frightening dreams, negative thoughts, or unpleasant feelings. What this refers to is that, again, this is where the work is. We're not working in the areas where we are brilliant and relaxed and positive, where our actions in the world are received and our the feedback from the world is that we are on our way to building something constructive and powerful. Where the observer self is most valuable is in the areas where we are not well developed, in areas where we feel and are immature, undeveloped. When negativity exists, it just does. It shouldn't be excused, it shouldn't be negated, and it shouldn't be minimized. It needs to be seen and looked at, but from a place of support, because you can't fix it if you can't see it. And any judgment will drive negativity underground again. So also self-indulgence, denial, or rationalization, these are not real love. These are not the things that the observer self should be offering you. They only keep us, those things only keep us from unpleasant truths. So if you hear a voice in your head saying, oh, that's okay, it doesn't really matter, I would question whether that is the observer self. Because the observer self might say, that doesn't seem like a priority. But there's a difference. One has an attitude of put it down, put it away, and behind that there's a sense of, we don't want to deal with that. The observer self may be able to say, we don't have time to deal with that right now. But if we do have time, let's take a look at it. Let's sit down and write some notes. Let's do some journaling. You know, there's a time and a place for looking at unpleasant stuff. It's not necessarily when you're pressured on a deadline. But there's a difference between putting something away because you're afraid to look at it or uncomfortable at looking at it, and simply saying, we don't have time for that right now. This would be the difference in the voices. One would be the observer self, and another might be a different frequency or energy of voice. So our negative aspects can be seen as immature children within us that need our attention and love in order to grow up into mature self-expression. And at that point, we go back to Lecture 189, which teaches the moment you identify them, you cease being identified with them. And there is a lecture on this. I do not remember the number. I apologize. I believe it's 195, but I could be wrong, where this point is expressed more forcefully. And that is that just because you see a negative aspect in yourself does not mean you are negative. There is a difference. And this is what I talked about in the beginning, that seeing a quality in you that you do not admire or that you wish was more mature is not the same as being immature. It acknowledges an immaturity. It acknowledges a negative force or current in you that wants to duck and run. But being able to see that is the first step in dealing with it. And in the past, sometimes when we grow up, if we admit that we've done something, if you admit, for instance, that you lied, little kids will say, "Ah, you're a liar," and they'll point at you. Well, yes, that's true. It's not very supportive. And it can make us pull back from being self-revelatory, from revealing ourselves to others, because we sometimes aren't certain how big this negativity is. One of the places that I use as an example with some trepidation is that I used to collect little coffee spoons from airlines. Now, I think that's not very admirable. And so there's a place in me that either a kleptomaniac or a thief, and I just don't want to be too harsh about it. Anyway, I collect the little coffee spoons. And as I did a lot of flying back and forth to Australia, I was on airlines a lot, and there were a lot of coffee spoons. So I wound up with a little cupful of tiny coffee spoons that I thought were adorable, and they were souvenirs to me of my trip. And yet there's a voice in me that says, "You stole the spoons." The voice that tells me you stole the spoons is not my objective observer, even though that may be an objective reality. That's the distinction. My objective observer understands the human need for souvenirs. It understands how I thought the spoons were cute. There's a list. It just understands all that stuff. But it also understands that I have a somewhat idealized sense of integrity and honesty, and the spoons bother me. So the objective observer is dealing with these two realities. The spoons aren't that important per se, but it bothers her. And there's a part of Jan that thinks she's a thief because she collects coffee spoons. And this actually affects her ability to respect herself. It's a serious matter. I had to stop collecting coffee spoons. Not because it is per se a terrible thing to do, and not because the airlines really care. But I had to stop collecting them because it made me feel bad in ways I couldn't quite put my finger on, and it wasn't worth it. In fact, I did tell that to someone, and they got very upset with me because I'm supposed to hold a higher standard of honesty than the average person because I teach this stuff. And that made me feel worse. And then I told a friend, and the next time she flew in to meet me, she handed me a coffee spoon because she thought it was adorable, and she felt that it wasn't terrible. Now, I'm going on and on and on about the coffee spoon, but what I'm trying to build here is an example of a situation, a very petty and minor situation, where my judgments on my own actions are far worse and far more damaging to me than the actuality of the act, and that when I expose myself to others, I may trigger their own concerns about honesty, or, in this case, their concerns about whether they can trust me as a therapist because I filch coffee off airlines. And then when a friend supported me in this, it felt like an overwhelming wave of love that someone would see my immaturity and see this silly thing that I did and say, it's probably okay, Jen, and I will support you in it. The observer's self was not terribly active during this petty activity. But if it was, I believe it would have stood the way my friend stood, but would also have stood with my concerns about my integrity. The objective observer would have held both. Loving me for what I care about, and also loving me for what I hold as a value, and noticing where I do not meet those values. Now, one of the easiest ways to develop the observer self is through daily review. And I've spoken at length about that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop for a moment and change the tape, and then go into a little bit of how that can be, in effect, an exercise in developing the observer self.